Thank you for agreeing to this private meeting, Mrs. Clinton.
We don't have to be so formal, Bernie. Feel free to call me Madam Secretary.
How is that less formal?
Because I say it is. Now, what do you want?
I'm concerned that people aren't following our campaigns. They seem so much more interested in the Republicans. They have these debates. They talk about their sex organs and scream insults at each other. People are eating it up.
We have debates?
We had one last night, opposite the series finale of Downton Abbey.
I know. I can't believe that Lady Mary finally...
Don't tell me. I DVR'd it. That's the thing, Madam Secretary. Even I didn't want to watch the debate. I wanted to see if Thomas the Footman finally gets health care. Somehow you got all these debates scheduled when nobody watches.
So what's your solution?
I think we should say crude and insulting things to each other.
For example?
You could make jokes that I'm incontinent. You could say, what if Bernie's meeting with foreign leaders and he makes in his pants?
And what would you say about me?
Well, I could make fun of all the money
No.
Well, how about if I joked about your husband's...
No.
I could say, you don't even have
No.
a... Then what can I say?
You could say, Hillary's IQ is so high that people forget to notice how great she smells.
How is that an insult?
You could say, I don't want to say Hillary works hard for the American people, but if she sacrificed any more of herself, she'd ascend body and soul into heaven.
That's not a put down.
No, but it's true.
So we have to keep saying substantive things about gun control, the environment, and trade policy?
I think that's more our style. Besides, oh my God, you wet yourself!
I did!
Gotcha! Let's listen to a show about the shape of the presidential race. And now he's secretly relieved that Ben Carson has more time to be his primary care physician, Colin McEnroe.
Actually, I feel like I need Dr. Ben Carson as my primary care physician today, partly because I have to confess, I'm just back from vacation. I've spent a week in San Francisco, and I'm really having an unusually hard time making that transition. You know the transition I'm talking about, right? Where you actually believe that you're, or you don't really believe initially that you're back at work and that the normal laws of work apply. I mean, I've been sort of walking around the newsroom going, we're doing a show? Like, on the radio? Really? Now? So we thought, well, the best thing to do maybe since maybe Colin isn't functioning at 100% here is to start off with a really great guest, somebody who could very easily host his own show, somebody who in fact does co-host his own podcast, somebody who's funny and substantive at the same time. So we got Steve Allman, who's the author of Candy Freak and most recently Against Football, A Reluctant Manifesto. He's been on our show many times. He's now the co-host of the podcast Dear Sugar Radio with Cheryl Strayed. And most recently, Steve has written in Salon about the fact that he, a liberal, I think it's fair to say, is rooting for Donald Trump to win the Republican nomination. Now, this isn't necessarily, he's not the only person doing this. A lot of people think, in terms of gaming this whole thing out, that this is a way to seal the general election on behalf of the Democrats. But we thought it would be interesting to talk to Steve about this. And it's not even an idea that, Steve, that you have even successfully sold in your own household, as I understand it. So far, your wife is not buying this, right?
She is not buying, yeah. She is of that fairly large camp of people who are simply horrified by the idea that one of the major parties would nominate somebody who is so clearly, you know, unqualified, is kind of narcissistic and morally hollow, is really more of an ad man or a demagogue than an actual civic entity. You know, Trump is really a salesman, and that's essentially what he's about. And so I think she's understandably, like a lot of people, is essentially saying, you know, I want to believe that the Republican Party will do better than this and will put up a candidate who is of some substance, has some experience, is not going to be walking around showing the nuclear codes to a bunch of hot models and saying, do you want to play with the buttons?
You've conjured up a prospect. I hadn't even thought about that one. But all right. So what do you say back? Let's eavesdrop on the household here. And obviously, your answers to this is that one of the other, I mean, the most likely other possibility is Ted Cruz, who, doesn't conform to any of your wife's desire for a palatable Republican candidate. But just in terms of Trump, in terms of
sure.
How you see the Trump scenario playing out, what do you say?
Well, the central thing is, look, ever since, really dating back even further than this, but ever since Nixon and his people conceived of a Southern strategy. They essentially said, let us start to use various kinds of dog whistles to signal that we are the party that is against civil rights, that is ultimately against integration, that is against policies that will create equality of opportunity, and especially that there is a certain very stubborn, look at the electoral map, there's a certain very stubborn kind of set of anxieties that live inside Caucasian white voters, especially if they are economically insecure and feel culturally dislocated. And the GOP has been playing on these anxieties, racial anxieties, cultural anxieties, gender anxieties, for 40 years, for 50 years. They have been dining on this. They have been inciting their base with these racist and nativist kind of rhetoric. You can trace it back to Willie Horton. You can go back to Reagan and his welfare queens, all of this coded language, these dog whistles. And Trump has come along and basically wolf whistles. He says very overtly, Mexicans are rapists, and let's keep Muslims out of the country. And he is speaking for that large band of the electorate, all of whom are American citizens, are entitled to their one vote that's equal to yours or mine or anybody else's. That base has been incited for years. And then that's sort of been attached with kind of Elmer's glue to the basic donor class Republican agenda, which is slash regulation, slash taxes, make sure the rich get theirs. That's not what the base is into. What the base is into is that they feel ripped off, and they want some loudmouth who can reduce the moral complexity of America in 2013 or 2016 or 1996 to a narrative that they understand emotionally, which is one about how they're being ripped off and left behind and who's to blame for that. So they found that, the establishment is freaking out because they have for a generation been breeding these ditto heads, these kind of frightened, low-information voters who are driven by grievance and desperate for some kind of authoritarian voice to follow. And that is who Donald Trump is. Just in a basic justice sense, that is what the Republicans allowed their party to become, and they should live with the results of it.
Well, now, so here's one thing that we, I think, did conclude over the past two presidential electoral cycles is that any strategy resembling the one that you just described is doomed to fail, that, in fact, you have to keep up with history and you have to keep up with demographics, and that you can't run a campaign that's unpalatable to any voter of color. You can't run a campaign that's unpalatable to the emergent millennial voting group, which we'll be talking about in the second half of the show today, so that doesn't work. And that the Republicans, in just conferring among themselves, seemed very determined to come into this cycle and have a candidate who would be more appealing to a broader base of Americans, representing, recognizing that the whole framework of electoral politics has changed and has tilted much more towards diversity. And somehow or other, so maybe a guy like Jeb Bush really did seem like a much more appropriate kind of person to put up there. Sure. But this process, it hasn't worked that way. And are you at all, obviously one thing that you could conclude, and you do conclude in your article, is that therefore they are about to nominate somebody who can't win for all the reasons I just described. But are you at all chastened by the fact that every single predictive model that's been applied to Donald Trump's candidacy so far has been wrong?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I think anybody who's blasé about saying, well, there's no way he can win because he's so unpopular with the, broader swath of voters, is being naive and foolish. We get the leaders we deserve, and maybe we are a nation right now who is so divorced, so inattentive, so anxious, and so divorced from the real moral conversation we should be having around politics that we wind up with a kind of salesman, with a kind of a sort of cheap demagogue with his gold-plated ideas. What I would say about that Republican line or the sort of conventional beltway wisdom that the Republicans have to nominate somebody who's more centrist, that's nonsense. That is not what happens every single election cycle. They finally got old Mitt Romney nominated last time, but it was after they'd taken every other clunker for a test drive. What the base wants. The GOP has played with fire for years and years and years, rather than coming up with an actual vision for what they want to do that's something other than just making rich people richer, an actual campaign platform that could appeal to a broad range of Americans. What they've had to do is get people incited and work them up and try to treat them like useful idiots. And those useful idiots are called American citizens, and they get a vote. And every single time there's an election on the right, those people show up because they're passionate. Their feelings have been inflamed. Their primal negative emotions have been inflamed. And, you know, they get a vote, too. They are a part of the democratic process, and that's what the quote-unquote establishment is realizing. And any time a Mitt Romney or somebody else or somebody in the media speaks out against Trump, you're just throwing oil onto the sort of the bonfire of his supporters who feel very, you know, Bernie Sanders in his way is appealing to the same sense that the establishment and our civic organizations and our civic institutions are fundamentally broken. His solution is we've got to make, you know, income and opportunity more equal. Trump just says, don't worry, I got a plan, guys, and I got a big one, too, in my pants. He just says kind of basic, powerful, authoritarian stuff that for people who are frightened and want a kind of spectacle to vote for, are ready to say, I'll sign on for that. But the larger thing is all of this media cogitation about what should happen and doing the math and trying to figure out how to craft a message, that's not where Trump's voters live. And we don't know how many of them there are. When he goes, you know, it's time for him to run in the general election, maybe we'll discover that we're a very different America from the one that most of us think we are.
Yeah. You know, in reading your article, we're talking to Steve Allman right now, you make a very compelling case. On the other hand, there's another way to read one of the cases you make, and you're making it now, too, is that Trump is not so much an anomaly as a more open and forceful manifestation of currents that you're aware of in the Republican Party going back, as you say, 40 years. On the other hand, you could say that he is an anomaly, that in 2000 in nominating George W. Bush, I mean, George W. Bush had all of his liabilities that we learned about, but at the time, their message was this super inclusive one. If you remember that Philadelphia convention where they were showcasing any minority they could find, and Bush was, you know, really making a lot of his own ties to the Latino community, they really tried to market themselves as the proverbial big tent at that time. You know, going with McCain in 2008, once again, you know, trying, as you say, after maybe rejecting a bunch of wingnuts, trying to get a guy who presents as a centrist and with some evolved thinking about stuff like climate change, going with Romney 4 years later, as you say, right. You know, more of a centrist Republican, maybe after they threw away some of the guys who weren't. That basically what the Republicans do every time is they date the hard right, and then they nominate, they marry, you know, the center. And yeah. And in this sense, Trump might really be an anomaly, one of these guys who, unless actually he is that centrist candidate, as you say in your article, there are a lot of things, whether it's adventurism in Iraq or Planned Parenthood, there's some ways in which Trump is a centrist candidate. He's just also scary.
He's not ideologically enslaved to the sort of modern conservative dogma. He can say whatever he wants, which is part of his appeal. But Colin, I would say that the narrative you're setting out is really coming up against the idea of an African American being elected president, the rise of the Tea Party, the rise of Republican obstructionism as the basic goal of the Republican Party. Mitch McConnell didn't stand up after Obama was elected and say, we're going to try to make these things come true for our constituents. We're going to try to, you know, work to try and solve these problems, knowing that we don't agree with the Democrats on a solution. That wasn't what he said. He said, we want to get this guy out of office. And I think that they have very consciously and in a concerted way, and it's really ultimately nihilistic, they are no longer a party that is about ideas and even the pretense of appealing to or trying to solve problems. I can't think of a single problem that they quote-unquote want to solve other than the deficit and making government smaller, slashing regulation, lowering taxes for everybody, but especially the wealthy. I mean, they are beholden at this point at the upper echelons to the donor class. And so their policy solutions are all about people who have lots and lots and lots of zeros in the checks that they receive. And that is not something they can sell to the American public, to the working class white voters. What can they sell? Well, that's what Donald Trump has in his, you know, handy dandy salesman kit, a kind of authoritarian voice that says that basically is big and tough on your behalf and that promises in the most empty manner that he's going to solve it. I mean, Colin, you surely, I know you've been on vacation and I'm sure it was great, but you have been listening to what this guy says. And just as a smart guy and somebody who follows politics, have you ever seen somebody make so many patently empty promises? I mean, these are sort of second grade promises, like, don't worry, I'll take care. Oh, ISIS, we're going to take care of him. There's nothing there. But they've been moving towards nothing there for 40 years.
So one of the arguments, therefore, is that when he gets into a general election cycle, no matter who he's running against, but especially if he's running against Hillary Clinton, he's going to be up against a person with a tremendous command of fact and detail. And he has almost no command of fact or detail and very little interest in using that to back up his assertions.
Right.
That tends to give hope and cheer to Democrats. On the other hand, you know, in 2000... Yeah, well, yeah, maybe we can talk about this. In 2000, we saw Al Gore, also a consummate detail person, running against George W. Bush.
Bingo.
Yeah, a little dry on details. And people preferred that. In some ways, Gore came off as the smart alecky kid who did the extra homework and tried to taunt George W. Bush by saying, you don't even know what Dingle Norwood is, do you?
Right.
Well, and everybody sitting at home went, no, and neither do we, and we don't care. And, you know, so, yeah.
I think what's going to happen, I mean, you know, people can try to treat this election like an election where important decisions are going to be made about policy, the future of the country, They can try to do that. If Donald Trump is elected, it's going to be a bar fight. And what you're going to see is essentially an endless relitigation of all the phony scandals that, you know, Hillary Clinton has ever been embroiled in. And anytime Hillary Clinton wants to talk about actual policy, foreign, you know, some kind of foreign policy, you know, economic positions, anytime she wants to take the American voter into the quote-unquote weeds and actually talk about what she wants to do and how she's qualified and what her plan is and challenge Trump about his ideas and his plan and his agenda, he is just going to say, remember Travelgate? Remember Benghazi? And that's the thing to me that is ultimately depressing about this. I can already see that this guy is going to turn this election into, and if it's Cruz, it'll be the same thing, by the way. The only Republican position that works at this point is a kind of attack on, a relentless attack on Clinton and her scandals, trying to make her, put her on the defensive and keep the election from being about the important decisions that the country has to make. Ultimately, Republicans lose when that's the debate. That's why I'm a Bernie guy to some extent, not only because I agree with his positions, but because you can't really attack Bernie Sanders on any scandals. He doesn't have any. His one big scandal is he's way too far to the left for the modern, you know, political zeitgeist. And it's dispiriting to me because I can already see how the election is going to play out. I know exactly what's going to happen. It's going to be a relentless attack on Hillary Clinton, trying to gin up all these phony scandals and relitigating them over and over again, and the media is going to lap it up because it's conflict-based. And it's mean, and it appeals, you know, it gets eyeballs, it gets people listening, it's conflict. And very little of consequence is going to be discussed about the really serious issues that America's got to confront.
Let's take a break right here. We'll come back with more of Steve Allman. I think we've got a nice segue into something I wanted to talk to Steve about anyway. So we'll take a break. We'll come back.
Enemies of freedom. Face the music. Come on, boys, take them down.
All right, so we're back with Steve Allman. He's a perfect guest to have on my first day back from vacation because he can carry the ball, although he doesn't carry footballs anymore. He's the author of Against Football, A Reluctant Manifesto, also Candy Freak. He's been on our show to talk about all kinds of things. This might be the first time you've ever been on to talk about politics. He's also the co-host of the podcast Dear Sugar Radio with Cheryl Strayed. And to that point, Steve, I have something else I want to get into you with you, too, or however you put those prepositions in a row. But the first thing I wanted to say, maybe apropos more of your podcast a little bit, is I think I'm a little older than you are, but have you ever lived through an election cycle through which everything is refracted? Every aspect of reality is now refracted. You can't go to a dinner party. You can't go anywhere without finding yourself in one of these conversations. And I'm thinking it has to do with the fact that this this election, although it tests our ideologies and it tests our understanding of how politics works, it's increasingly testing our understanding of how reality works,
yeah.
Whether we've walked into some kind of Star Trek holodeck experience where the normal rules of behavior and fact and reality don't even apply.
Yeah. Well, in a way, that's why I also am rooting for Trump. I think that you gave George Bush as an example, George W. Bush. That was a guy who convinced voters that he was something he wasn't, a compassionate conservative, that he wasn't going to be, didn't imagine that his policies, foreign policy, would be so hawkish. And we just didn't imagine that he would list as far to the right and be as an extreme conservative, because that's not how he hawked himself. So there was something dishonest about the way in which he ran. I guess you could argue that's true of any politician, but somebody like Marco Rubio would, if he got the nomination, he would essentially list to the center again and try to, be inclusive and make the right sort of noises so that he could appeal to a broader base than just the right wing space. But the truth is that my feeling is that Trump is very much where a lot of Americans are at, not a majority by any means, but, given how many people vote in elections, you don't have to have a majority of the voters. You just have to have a passionate fourth of them, maybe. And the reality is that we have to confront that you and I, Colin, live in our own America. And there are other Americans who have a very different, especially in the age of the digital age, where people are seeking out their own confirmation bias news stories. Everybody's constructing a very different version of the reality. The reality, I think, is that, Obama has been a kind of technocratic, somewhat dispassionate, slightly to the left of Bob Dole, or maybe around at Bob Dole's policy positions. And he's had a very hard time getting anything done because the Republican Party has essentially said, let's obstruct anything this guy might want to do. For whatever reasons, that's what our base wants. That's the reality, I think, of who Barack Obama is as a politician. But that's not the reality at certain dinner parties or barbecues or whatever. The reality is that he's a Muslim. The reality is he's a Manchurian candidate who's, trying to redistribute wealth and bring the next communist, revolution to the country. And in other, gatherings, it might be Obama is our savior, and Obama is a guy who's, just trying to do everything right, and I believe in his program entirely. People have different sets of facts. And one of the things that's fascinating about a national election is that it forces everybody, or at least it impels everybody, to have a conversation about what kind of country we are. The reason I'm excited about Bernie Sanders is partly because for the first time he's putting certain basic issues onto the agenda in an overt way that can't be wiggled around or punted away. The idea that we have massive inequality of wealth, that we regard certain things like education or health care as, hey, if you can afford it in capitalism, then you get it. He's saying, actually, I don't believe that. It's a kind of New Deal or a second New Deal that he's putting forward, a different idea of how money should be divided in the country and what our moral and civic priorities should be. And I'm not trying to stump for Bernie Sanders. I don't care who brought that message. That's something that I deeply agree with and resonates with me. The problem is that there is another America, and those people are all equally American to me. They get one vote. They deserve that vote, who think that anybody who would support Bernie Sanders is, wearing a French sailor suit, whistling the Soviet national anthem, as I am, in fact, wearing a French sailor suit. But you know that about me already.
But yeah, that predates Bernie's candidacy.
Exactly.
Let me just ask you one last thing about this, Steve, which is that, and the stuff that you've been saying right now, by the way, is just a great segue into our next segment. I know John Pettis in particular wants to talk about this whole idea of people's subjective realities that are sort of, and whether or not those subjective realities are impervious to Enlightenment era logic and rational examination. But, just for the sake of argument, one thing that has occurred to me is that the Republicans can, with some legitimacy, say that this has been a more voter-driven and open process than the Democratic nomination process, that they've had a lot of debates with a lot of candidates and a lot of primaries and huge turnout. They're breaking turnout records everywhere that they go, a lot of participation, and just let these people sort it out and figure out who it is that they want and And if Trump is who they pick, then so be it. Whereas, in fact, the Democratic process so far, the capital D Democratic process, feels very orchestrated. The very limited debate schedule, very closely controlled process that seemed engineered to guarantee the nomination of Hillary Clinton in lots of different ways. And, you know, even now, sort of familiar Clinton-esque uncertainties. Did we really get the right vote total and delegate total out of Iowa, or did stuff go on? And it seems, oddly enough, less small D Democratic than the Republican process.
Well, certainly the superdelegate thing, you know, and this is, again, something that not a lot of people are focused on, as you alluded to in your open. You know, Americans, human beings, are drawn to conflict. They're drawn to sort of vulgarity. Literally, the root of that is, you know, something that is popular to a lot of people. So a bunch of guys standing on stage talking about, you know, how big their sexual equipment is, or calling one another jerks, that kind of hits our limbic system. I don't think that the Republicans have had debates of – I don't have a clear idea of what any of those guys want to do to create jobs or to, create – additional educational opportunity for Americans, take on the problems that scientists tell us we have, pressing problems having to do with climate change. I don't think they've been debates in the sense of actual discussion of policy. I think the Democrats have actually done pretty well in talking about the stuff that they want to do and that is of moral concern to them. So I don't know that I would say that on the GOP side there has been an honest debate of issues. What I think there has been is a kind of pageant. It's become a kind of reality TV show. Well, guess who's leading the charge? Mm-hmm. It's a guy who knows reality TV. He knows about villainy. He knows about remaining in the news cycle, about saying something outrageous enough. And I don't think, by the way, that Donald Trump is planning all of this. I think it's a moment where a guy who's essentially adolescent is suddenly interacting with an electorate and a media that feeds on a kind of regressed adolescent view of life. That's very self-involved, that's very about braggadocio, and that is very little about a consideration of sort of the moral state of the country and the things we need to do to solve those problems. I am heartbroken to say all of this, but maybe that's the America, Colin, that we'll find out most of people who head out to the voting booth and pull a lever are interested in, that is about spectacle and entertainment rather than about the moral undertaking that voting is supposed to be. That would be a great tragedy in this historical moment if that was the case. But at least with Trump as the nominee, you know that's what the that's what the Democratic process of the Republican primaries has produced. They've produced a guy who is the logical candidate for that party given where they are. And the question is his act, his shtick, his bluster, which is completely free of any real attempt to solve problems. It's much more about an emotional appeal. He's just the apotheosis of what the GOP has been building towards for years and years and decades. And it is up to all of America to have this conversation about whether they want that person to be their president/king/dictator.
All right. On that inspiring and uplifting note, we're going to have to stop here and go to a break. Steve Allman, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Always a pleasure.
All right. We'll be back with a conversation about the millennial generation and their impact on this campaign.
Join the fight. Vote for me. I can't exactly tell you why, but here's my battle cry. Vote for me. Vote for me. Vote for me.
Today's show is produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Our interns are Tiana Duquette and Alexandra Ingber. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Mitt Romney. For show pages, articles, and PDFs of the secret plan to nominate Robin Young at brokered convention, go to our website, WNPR.org/Colin. On tomorrow's show, put on your Snuggie and listen to our infomercial show. And now, back to Colin.
Yes, actually, I'm starting to look forward to this infomercial show. Kevin Harrington, who was one of the original sharks on Shark Tank, will be joining us, as will Ron Popeil, who's sort of the, he's the Tigris and Euphrates of the infomercial civilization, if that's what it is. Anyway, today we're talking about politics. I was out on the West Coast last week, just mostly having fun, but I went to this interesting event held by Brigade.com to watch the Super Tuesday returns. This was in the SoMa section of San Francisco. Lots of people there. A lot of, very sort of data-driven people, a lot of quants and code monkeys there. And as I was looking around the room, I was thinking, you know, we've gotten so good with data in this country. I mean, we really do. I mean, Amazon knows what book you're going to read next, and Facebook knows that you like to look at baby pictures or whatever it is you like to look at on Facebook. But we haven't really been able to predict anything very well in this election cycle. I mean, we don't, you know, everything. Even Nate Silver is consistently wrong, particularly about Donald Trump, that, you know, that we're so smart about this stuff, except when it comes to the leadership of our country, which you would think would be a pretty pressing concern. So why is it so hard? Why is it so difficult this time around to understand what's happening, why it's happening, and to know it's going to happen before it does happen? And so, I don't know, I was looking for people to talk to. Anyway, I ran into this very smart guy out there at this particular Brigade event. His name is John Pettis. He's the founder and CEO of Fiskit, a social media platform with the goal to bring more logic and civility to online commentary. So a nice jump from what Steve was saying to that. But I also especially wanted to talk to John and some other people about millennials. There were a lot of millennials in that room in San Francisco, and I was thinking maybe one of the things that makes this election problematic and difficult to understand is a lot of it has to be programmed to this gigantic age cohort that's politically not very well understood. They've seemed traditionally a little less engaged politically, much less likely to affiliate with a party, and they get their news and they get their information a different way from the generations that preceded them. So maybe that's some of what's making this a complicated equation. So John is here to talk to us about this, and so is Bruce Tolgan, founder and chairman of Rainmaker Thinking and the author of many books, most recently Not Everyone Gets a Trophy, How to Manage Millennials. So Bruce, I'm going to start out with you and kind of just let you set up the playing field a little bit here. Anyway, the term millennial is, first of all, a term that gets slung around a lot. So who are we talking about in terms of age? Which age cohort is this?
Yeah, thank you for having me on the show, Colin. And the millennial cohort, I mean, we've been tracking young people in the workplace now for 23 years. And so we've looked very closely at the millennials. And, you know, people are talking about, usually they're talking about the youngest, least experienced people. So the youngest voters right now are those, say, 18 to 26. Mm-hmm. That's really only half of the millennials. Mm-hmm. And they're what we call the second wave millennials. If you look at the oldest millennials are in their late 30s, right? So if you look at the giant millennial cohort, one thing that helps is if you split it into two segments, the first wave and the second wave, sort of like the baby boomers come in two waves. And starting to unpack this question about how young people are behaving, I think what most people are zeroing in on is those second wave millennials, those very youngest voters, you know, many of whom, of course, were not old enough to vote for Obama in 2008. And I think one of the reasons people are so interested in the behavior of young voters is because they were such a driving force in making President Obama's election possible in 2008 and again in the re-election in 2012. So people are looking very carefully, where are they going to go this year? And of course, you know, a lot of people are saying they're going to Trump and to Sanders, which is baffling to many.
Well, so John, help us out with this. So one of the real questions that you're trying to deal with involves how people think, and particularly how this generation that gets a lot of information from the digital environment, uses its phone more than it uses a lot of other devices, how they get information and how they evaluate that information. And, you know, we could argue that people don't really change that much, that they evaluate information pretty viscerally, make pretty much knee-jerk decisions based on a whole set of biases that they start out with. But you could also want to know more about specifically this group of people and people who consume content online, what they know, how they know it, how they assess its validity. So what are your working hypotheses about that now?
Yeah, well, so it's actually a very interesting phenomenon. Of course, you know, millennials are kind of wired to their phones, and so that is definitely a true and very relevant phenomenon for this generation. But it's also true that they are kind of growing up into the established, what David Frum calls the political entertainment complex, mm-hmm. right? So they are coming into a world where politics and entertainment have already fused to a bit. And they are coming at it from a perspective in which they're constantly enveloping themselves in information and not just the nightly news, they have constant access to information from multiple sources. So one of the things that's very distinct about this generation is their level of access to information is unprecedented. So especially when it comes to the specifics of issues or the facts of the situation, they can get to that information. There is no barrier to them actually finding out the truth, which actually brings us to the more interesting question, which is why have we seen such a divergence in young people on the question of the truth? Because one of the things that we've learned, and especially one of the things that I've learned as I've been building my company, is that the new battlefield is what is the truth? The battlefield is over the fact. And that is a strangely new phenomenon in our political lives, not just for millennials.
Go ahead, Bruce.
Really powerful point. Mm-hmm.
Did you want to elaborate on that, Bruce? Maybe as you elaborate, Bruce, one thing that you could also deal with a little bit is my sense, and just in my reading about millennials, is that they're carrying this kind of information machine around with them all the time. They may be a lot more interested in those kinds of questions than some of their predecessors, who tended to make permanent alliances. People tended to, you know, self-identify as liberals or conservatives, or especially Democrats or Republicans. Millennials tend to affiliate with parties at a much lower rate. One gets the sense that you have to reach them with something other than just a label.
Yeah, and it's not about where they arrive. It's about the process, and so determining what's true, that's very powerful, because this is a moving target, right? And so it's not just that millennials, their information environment is defined by wireless internet ubiquity and technology integration and infinite content and immediately available answers to everything. But they're also constantly mixing and matching information. They're manipulating this infinite array of sources, and they're not just creating a mindset about reality, but they're projecting back out into the world their own ever-changing personal montage of information, knowledge, meaning, and self-expression. So their experience of civics and citizenship and political participation is part of their trying on of personas virtually. And social media makes it very easy to experiment with more extreme versions of one persona or another. And by the way, more crass means of expression. And it allows them to try on ideas, try on realities. And this, of course, in a non-geographic environment, right? Their world is so diverse and integrated because their boundaries, there are no boundaries. So this idea of, it's not just that they can always find the right answer, right? It's that they can find an infinite number of answers to any question and create their own reality. And so I think their sense of political participation as pulling the lever and affecting government to make change in public policy, that's not how they think of it. They do care about public policy. They care about issues. Their experience of politics is somehow disconnected from that. It's more about experiencing the information environment and expressing themselves and trying on personas.
Go ahead, John. I would just say, to
Bruce's point, so it's true that there's definitely lower party affiliation, and they are able to go out and seek out many different points of view. But one of the most interesting phenomena that we see among the younger generation and the more digitally literate folks is that despite that, what we see is they are actually hardening into very discrete ideological camps. So despite the fact that they have access to all kinds of different viewpoints, this generation may be one of the most polarized in terms of the number and varied number and types of perspectives they actually receive. And this is the phenomenon that was made famous in a great TED Talk by Eli Pariser called the filter bubble. And some people call it also epistemic closure. And this is the phenomenon where people choose to read news that reinforces their current viewpoint, and because it makes them feel good. And this kind of connects over to the political entertainment complex. There's an amazing quote by Justice Scalia, actually, about 3 or 4 years ago. Someone asked him, Mr. Justice, what do you read in the morning? And he says, well, I read the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Times. And they say, you don't read the Washington Post or your hometown newspaper? And he said, no, why would I want to get angry every morning? And that is, you know, this is one of the most learned and important men in our country. And he self-selects the information that he receives because he doesn't want to read stuff that he disagrees with. And that is true of all of us, no matter kind of how high-minded we are. And that is especially true when you live in a supercharged, high-information environment. People read the stuff that confirms their previous worldview, and they tend not to interpret or receive as much that challenges their worldview. And there is a technological issue there, because as they click through and like things and read and share things, the algorithms of Facebook and Twitter and all these technology platforms will see what you like and send you more of it because that's what makes you happy. And so we have, this is what leads to the culture that we are developing, in which you have two groups of people, large groups of people, who firmly and confidently believe things that are mutually exclusive. They cannot both be true. They believe in different sets of facts. And this is, makes it incredibly hard to have political discourse, because if you can't agree that up isn't down, it's very hard to have a nuanced discussion about what the appropriate top marginal tax rate is.
Right. That problem may have been around for longer than you think. But I want to come back to that. But, Bruce, at this point, Bernie Sanders seems to be able to communicate very effectively with millennials, and I think with a certain group of millennials. Maybe Donald Trump does too. But imagine, and I know from your emails that this is something you've thought a lot about, imagine a nomination of Hillary Clinton as for the Democratic Party. How does she tune what she says to the ears of this particular generation? Obviously, it's does them a disservice to generalize about them, but let's do that anyway. What kinds of terms, what kinds of music do they hear especially well?
Well, I think what's speaking to them is there's something they can latch on to and that they want to be part of their self-expression. The point that the minds of the generations are being so polarized and political ends, there's a lot of truth to that. But I see each individual is sort of developing his or her own montage almost of reality. And there's a lot of customization. And so they don't necessarily fit into ordinary buckets on the right and left. And so I think the trick for any candidate who's trying to appeal to them is for their political participation to somehow be an opportunity to express their sense of self and what they want to project back out into the world. Remember that there's a reason why the institutions, the way they look at institutions and government in particular, it shouldn't be a surprise. The youngest millennials, you know, they were children on 9/11. They were young teenagers when the economy collapsed in 2008. You know, it's terrorism and environmental cataclysm are the realities. The economy fluctuates from boom to bust. You know, the government shuts down. Greece might fail. Great companies, are falling apart. Institutions in every domain look like they might actually fall apart. So when Bernie Sanders and Trump talk about kind of detonating the system, to a lot of young people, that doesn't seem out of the question. That doesn't seem like some crazy idea. Revolution seems, you know, like a possibility maybe, although by and large, it's not that they're not able to turn out, but you're not going to see 60% of millennials say they're going to vote, but actually, 50% of them will at best.
John Pettis, we should first of all say that John's site, once again, is Fiskit. That's F-I-S-K-K-I-T. I encourage people to go take a look at what they're doing there. They're in their early stages, but they're doing some interesting stuff with evaluating or almost kind of socially evaluating the truth or falsehood, the validity of things that appear often in mainstream media outlets. But, to that end, John, one of the questions that I have has to do with on-ramps to information and political participation. Obviously, so many things that have happened have defied what was passing for settled wisdom. I mean, Bernie Sanders shouldn't be happening right now. You know, you shouldn't be a 70-year-old socialist Jew and doing that well in a mainstream political
popular
party.
Popular with 18-year-olds.
Yeah, so clearly, and if you had any doubt about that, the New York Times would tell you, and CBS would tell you, and Rush Limbaugh would tell you, and whoever it is that you were going to in the mainstream media or what passes for that would tell you. So somehow or other, there's a different on-ramp to political participation and information. I mean, do you feel as though you understand what's happening?
Yeah, so I really think that social media is the big story there. And, you know, it's amazing because we feel like we've been living in the era of Facebook and Twitter for so long now. But really, these things were completely nascent when Barack Obama first showed up on the scene. So this is going to be the first hotly contested presidential election that we've had in the social media era. And social media really, I think, provides this much lower barrier to entry, not only to receiving news, where you get kind of some friends share some kind of political stories that get in there. If you're not a political person, you kind of see some things. You might become aware that this Donald Trump thing is going along, and that's unusual. Or hey, you hear about this guy, Bernie Sanders. You're like, oh, man, that guy's talking about how tough it is for the middle class, and I'm really feeling that. Or he's talking about student loans, and I've been crushed by student loans. So I think there's both Bruce made a really good point about how it really is send and receive, and that's a real hallmark of social media, which is that it's a bi-directional communication. And your point about the on-ramp is very good, because a lot of people complain about this idea of slacktivism, which I really dislike the term and the concept. Which is that, young people don't care enough to actually get out in the streets and march or do something, create change. They're just going to, you know, like a story here and there, share something, and then they'll feel good, like they checked the box for their civic participation. But I don't think that's right at all. I think what it is that gives people an awareness and the ability to take the first step into civic participation. And the more and more they do that, the more aware they become of the issues. And they see this, what they call social proof. They see their friends also getting excited about Bernie Sanders. They see their friends talking about these ideas, and it becomes okay to get involved. And it comes from just this small act of liking or sharing a story, or you know, writing a little something about Bernie Sanders or what my issues are and how that actually, you know, impacts on the political world. But that, I think the barriers to entry have really decreased for drawing people into civic participation. And I think that's a really, really good thing.
Yeah, I mean, to Bruce's point about a revolution, I mean, there is a revolution that's happening that we will probably see manifest itself even more powerfully in subsequent election cycles. All these people who got on the on-ramp and discovered all this stuff and learned stuff on this cycle. Bruce Tolgan, who's the author of Not Everyone Gets a Trophy, How to Manage the Millennials. We're almost out of time, so I'm going to ask you to be brief in your answer. But one sense that I have is that, like a lot of young generations, millennials have very specific ideas about leadership and authority, and it's important to talk to them in the right way. Bernie Sanders has been cited for using we a lot. I'm assuming that's a pretty effective way to talk to millennials, is to say we rather than I.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, look, millennials typically have had closer relationships with their parents, teachers, and counselors than any generation in history. They love grown-ups. So, you know, they look at Bernie, it doesn't surprise me at all that they love this grown-up who's saying, you know, everything is corrupt. We've got to change everything. And, you know, I think Mrs. Clinton, if she could make the connection between their sense of the rigged system, and instead of seeing like one of the corrupt politicians, if she could make the connection between her ability to use the government to make change, I know that's the case she's trying to make, but somehow, you know, she seems too much part of the problem, I think, to the millennials.
All right, we're going to have to stop there, but check out John Pettis' new site. It's Fiskit, F-I-S-K-K-I-T. Check out Bruce Tolgan's book about millennials. We're going to be back tomorrow with a show about infomercials. You could say this campaign is one of the longer infomercials you've ever sat through. Politics is about, it's not that different from Ginsu knives. Us to down just because we get around.
for us get old.
Kyone, you've woken up from your coma.
What year is it?
2017.
Who is the president?
Donald Trump.
Doctor, can you put me back in the coma, please?